Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, October 19, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing insider trading and a case that was recently denied cert. That's why we're calling it a Courthouse Steps version of Teleform. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two return guests to Teleform today. We'll hear opening remarks from the two of them of about 30 minutes or so, but then, of course, we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so please be thinking of those questions in advance. We're going to hear first from Peter M. Thompson. He's special counsel at Stone Pigman Walther Whitman, and he'll be followed in opening remarks by James N. Burnham, who's an associate at Jones Day right here in Washington, D.C. But with that, Mr. Thompson, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good afternoon. So James and I thought that we would start with a quick, hopefully quick, refresher of the law, just to put in context the state of insider trading leading up to the Newman decision and the Supreme Court's denial of the writ application by the Justice Department. So Newman is clearly a significant setback for the government and a well-deserved, at least in my opinion, roadblock to the government's continued encroachment into criminal liability for insider trading, despite no clear statutory prohibition of this offense. So to put in context of the law over the past 30 or 40 years, I thought I would start with, we'll just start with the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934. And I ask that the veterans on the call who practice insider trading just bear with me for a moment for those who may not be as familiar. 15 U.S.C. 78J is the codification of the law from which insider trading law has derived over the past 40 or 50 years. So this statute makes it unlawful, and I'm going to read directly from it, to use or employ in the connection with the purchase or sale of any security, any manipulative or deceptive device or contrivance and contraventions of the rules and regs as the commission may prescribe as necessary. Now, pursuant to their authority, the SEC, of course, is empowered to issue these rules and regs, and they did in issuing Rule 10b-5. Rule 10b-5 was codified in 17 CFR 240.10b-5, and that provision specifically states that in connection with the purchase or sale of any security, it shall be unlawful for any person to employ any device, scheme, or artifice to defraud, or to engage in any act, practice, or course of business that operates or would operate as a fraud or deceit upon any person. Now, from those two, in my opinion, somewhat vague provisions, one a statute and one a CFR provision, enacted pursuant to Rule 10b-5. The courts have developed a body of criminal law that prescribe various specific prohibited types of conduct which the courts and the government allege violate those provisions. And the courts have developed this body of criminal law notwithstanding the fact that these provisions do not explicitly prohibit insider trading. Now, the courts over the years have developed two general theories of insider trading. One is called the classical theory, and the other is called the misappropriation theory. The classical theory is based on an insider, a corporate insider, trading securities of the corporation on the basis of material non-public information. The misappropriation theory extends the classical theory to outsiders, people who are outside of the corporation, who have no fiduciary duty to the shareholders of the corporation, who misappropriate this confidential information for trading purposes in a breach of duty to their source, whoever their source may be. Now, the material non-public information has been defined, or the materiality portion of that phrase has been defined as information where there's a substantial likelihood that disclosure would be viewed by a reasonable investor as altering the total mix of information available to investors. Now, turning first to the classical theory. Up until about 1980, when the Supreme Court rendered a decision called Chiarella, C-H-I-A-R-E-L-L-A, up to that point, the government was taking the position basically that anyone who trades on material non-public information breaks the law. Well, the Supreme Court in Chiarella announced what is known as the classical theory, which is derived from the fiduciary duty owed by the insider to the shareholders. And this fiduciary duty is grounded in a relationship of trust, of confidence and trust between the insider and the shareholders to the corporation. Because of this relationship, any trading that this insider does in that security qualifies under the jurisprudentially created theme as a deceptive device in violation of Section 78J. So under the classical theory, the corporate insider has a duty to not trade on the securities of that corporation. Or if he wants to trade in the securities, he must disclose to the shareholders the same information he has before trading. If he doesn't do that, then the theory is, the Supreme Court's theory was in that case, that the insider would have an unfair advantage over the shareholders to which he owes this fiduciary duty. Now, the fiduciary duty, in the eyes of the Supreme Court, applies not only to permanent insiders, such as the officers and directors of the corporation, but also to temporary fiduciaries, consultants, attorneys, accountants, for example. So, under the classical theory, it is illegal for the insider to trade on the basis of material non-public information. Now, it's important to note in Chiarella, the Supreme Court did state that regardless of its finding, still there is no general duty between all participants in all market transactions to not trade on material non-public information. In other words, the court also recognized in its holding that not every instance of financial inequity constitutes a crime under Rule 10b-5. Instead, the court limited liability to corporate insiders and those who work directly for the company who breached their fiduciary duty. Now, following that case, the Supreme Court rendered a decision in Dirks, and that's spelled D-I-R-K-S, which extended the prohibition to other people or to insiders who tip other people. This is commonly called tipper-tippee liability. Under this theory, and we're still within the classical or conventional theory of insider trading, insiders who don't trade on this confidential information but who tip others can be guilty as well, where the tippee, the person receiving the information, trades on the information knowing that their inside source has breached his duty to shareholders. So Dirks is really, it's a 1983 case. It's a seminal decision in this area. And it focused on the insider. It focused on the breach of his financial duty to the shareholders, that special, remember I mentioned it's special relationship of trust and confidence that he has with the shareholders, as opposed to the unfairness in possessing information. So the focus of the court was on the duties owed, and not so much the information being passed. The principles governing tipper liability, therefore, I'll summarize as follows. For the insider, who is the tipper, he is prohibited from disclosing material non-public information to an outsider or a tippee for personal gain. And it's very important to remember that the prohibition is on the insider to disclose to a tippee for personal gain to the insider. That violates the law under Dirks. As to the tippee, the theory is, he assumes through a derivative liability theory, the same financial duty that the insider owes to the shareholders. So when the tippee gets this information, where the tippee knows that the insider has breached that duty, where the tippee, so the tippee is aware that he's breached that duty, and the insider has benefited, then that is a violation of the law, and the tippee as well can be held accountable. However, without an insider breach of the duty, there can be no derivative breach for a tippee. So Dirks, in the aftermath of Dirks, a number of questions were still left, I think, unanswered, still in the classical setting of insider trading. For example, does a gift of, let's say, confidential information, corporate confidential information to someone's friend, to the insider's friend, does that satisfy the Dirks test? How would one define who is a friend? What kind of relationship do you have to have with this individual before that becomes a friend? What does the friend or the tippee friend have to know before that person's guilty of insider trading? Now, the government has taken the position, as would be expected, that a tip to any friend qualifies, that a friend, therefore, should be broadly defined, and that a friend would only be required to know of the breach and not be required to be aware that the insider, his insider friend, benefited in any way. Now, some years later, I think 15 or 20 years later, following Dirks, the Supreme Court, in a case called O'Hagan, O-H-A-G-A-N, again extended liability, insider trading liability. And again, as you can see, as we're going along, even though there's been no change in the law, in the written law, the courts continue to basically make things up as they go along. And in 1997, the Supreme Court announces what's known as the misappropriation theory. And under now this theory, we're no longer talking about insiders. We're now talking about an outsider to the corporation, who has no duty whatsoever to any of the shareholders of the corporation. The elements of insider trading under the misappropriation theory are, one, that a outsider with no duty to the shareholders misappropriates in some fashion material confidential information belonging to that corporation, that he does this for the purpose of trading or for the purpose of giving this information to another party, a third party downstream, while this misappropriator, I'll call him, is breaching his duty not to the shareholders, but to the source of the information. In this context, the duty being breached by the person misappropriating the information is based on a relationship of trust and confidence, as the Supreme Court has defined, to the source of the information. So in this decision, the Supreme Court, therefore, is extending liability for insider trading based on a precept that one is misappropriating this information by deception. And by misappropriating the information by deception in a breach of duty to the source, the misappropriator and the person that whoever he's tipping with this information is gaining an unfair advantage in the securities market and therefore triggering Rule 10b. So, again, what's left unresolved? Well, we still don't know at this point, following O'Hagan, what kinds of non-fiduciary relationships, we still don't know which kinds of non-fiduciary relationships qualify. And in the wake of O'Hagan, the SEC enacted some more rules. Because I can see I'm running up against my clock. I've already talked about 15 minutes. I'm going to speed through these rules. They enacted two more rules. One was Rule 10b-5-1, and the other was Rule 10b-5-2. And in these rules, the Supreme Court defined the duty of trust and confidence into three categories. First category, where a person agrees to maintain information and confidence. Second, where the two people sharing information have a prior history of sharing confidence or sharing information and confidence. And third, where information is shared with a close family member. Now, notwithstanding the clarifications that were reached with these rules, which I am admittedly skipping over the details of, the district courts continued to struggle to try to find common ground to identify which types of relationships qualify to apply the misappropriation theory. The very few appellate courts that looked at this also struggled to find common ground. One of the lingering unresolved questions, or another one, was whether the Dirks precepts, right, apply in a misappropriation case. So the Dirks requirements that the person passing on information to a third party must have a personal benefit, does that apply in a misappropriation case? The other Dirks requirement, that the tippee knows that his source has breached his duty, does that apply in a misappropriation case? I think the answer is most likely, but again, there has been some disagreement among the courts, particularly with regard to whether the misappropriator must benefit personally. And the Supreme Court has not yet ruled as to whether Dirks applies in this case. In any event, the government's position has been that anyone who misappropriates and gives to third parties has breached their duty, regardless of whether a personal benefit has been received. So turning back to the classical theory, and right before I turn this over to James, again, the classical theory is based on breaches of fiduciary duty to shareholders by insiders. But the lingering question in the classical theory has been, leading up to Newman, as to whether mere friendship satisfies the personal benefit requirement of Dirks. And certainly we know that the government's position is that an insider who gives confidential information to a friend can be held guilty without a showing of a financial benefit, without a showing of a quid pro quo. So on that question, I think that's an appropriate segue now to discuss the Newman decision and the Supreme Court's decision to decline writ review in that case, and I would turn this over to James.
Hi, everyone. This is James Burnham. I'm an associate at Jones Day, and thanks so much to Dean and the Federalist Society for having me, and to Peter for that great summary of insider trading law. Just by way of background, I did a blog post for the Federalist Society blog last week about this case, which you're welcome to read, although you're going to hear most of what I wrote from me today. So just a quick background on Newman, and I think Newman sort of illustrates a general principle here, which is that the government, through enforcement actions, has been trying, I think, pretty hard to push us to a world in which trading on inside information is itself illegal. And let me just explain that by talking about this case. So United States versus Newman was a tipper tippee case. But what was odd about Newman, or what was unique about Newman, is the people who actually did the trades, Newman and another hedge fund guy, whose name I believe was Chiasson, were several steps removed from the insider at the corporation. So there were tips that came from insiders at Dell and a company called NVIDIA. And those went to people who then told other people, who then told other people, who then told Newman and the other fella whose name I have trouble remembering. The government's theory, at least as the Second Circuit describes it in its opinion, was that because these hedge fund guys were, quote, sophisticated traders, end quote, they, quote, must have known that information was disclosed by insiders in breach of a fiduciary duty and not for any legitimate corporate purpose. The Second Circuit was not very impressed with that theory and vacated the convictions, not just overturning them on the jury instructions, but actually holding that there wasn't sufficient evidence to support them, which is a rather unusual thing for courts to do, because that means the government can never prosecute these two individuals for these crimes again. And it actually did so on two bases. So it did so first because there was no evidence, at least in the court's view, that the insiders at Dell and NVIDIA had received a, quote, personal benefit within the meaning of the law, and that's something that Peter touched on briefly, which is the traditionally under the classical theory, it's not a breach of fiduciary duty and therefore not insider trading if the insider is not disclosing the information in exchange for something, if there's not a quid pro quo. And one practical example that illustrates why, insiders routinely disclose insider information to favored financial analysts for totally legitimate corporate purposes. I am not a Wall Street guy, and I don't really practice in the securities field, but my understanding is that corporations will often have calls with certain investors, favored investors, market movers, opinion leaders, whatever, in which inside information will be disclosed. And that's not because they're bad. It's because they want to help the company stock price and serve their shareholders, and so they reveal things. So that's the benefit part of the coin, the personal benefit part. The other question in Newman was whether the person who's actually prosecuted for insider trading, in that case Mr. Newman, there had to be evidence that he knew that the original disclosure of inside information was in violation of a fiduciary duty. The Second Circuit held that they did have to know and that the benefit had to be something tangible. Let me see if I can find the quote. It had to be a, quote, the benefit had to be a, quote, meaningfully close personal relationship that generates an exchange that is objective, consequential, and represents at least a potential gain of a pecuniary or similarly valuable nature. And so they reversed on both those bases. After that happened, the Solicitor General sought cert in the case, but they only sought cert on one of the two issues, which is what constitutes a quote-unquote benefit for purposes of insider trading liability. And that might very well be one of the reasons why the Supreme Court declined to take the case. The defendants in the case pointed out to the Supreme Court, quite correctly, that even if it reversed on the benefit issue, it would not necessarily disturb the Second Circuit's ruling, because that ruling was also supported by the lack of knowledge that the defendants had. So the outcome might have been the same, probably would have been the same, and the Supreme Court typically does not take cases in which its decision will not reverse the outcome below. Now, moving on to the sort of the big picture part of this, I think one thing that's important to point out, and Peter did point this out, and I think it's worth emphasizing, it is legal to trade on inside information. That's not illegal. And indeed, a financial manager, like a hedge fund manager, has a fiduciary duty to the people who invest their money with him or her to trade as aggressively and intelligently and profit-making wise as possible. And so these people are obligated under legal doctrines to actually do everything they can to obtain as much information as possible to make as much money as they can for their investors. It's their job. And so when you have the government taking the position that people who are three or four steps removed from the inside information, that don't know where the inside information came from, are guilty of violating the insider trading statutes, that can be a pretty scary thing when you combine it with the fiduciary duty these people have to their investors. Now, it certainly could be, that Newman and Chiasson were just really sophisticated wrongdoers who were smart about not knowing what they didn't want to know, willfully blind, whatever. But it seems equally possible that these are just aggressive, successful hedge fund managers who managed to obtain inside information through perfectly appropriate means and then traded on it. I think that kind of brings us to the problem with insider trading law generally. You know, you all heard Peter's summary of the law. It's very, very complicated. Insider trading law has a lot of different facets and a lot of nuance, and almost none of that is written down anywhere other than in judicial opinions issued by judges acting as sort of common law courts. The Congress has certainly never even prohibited insider trading at all. It prohibited deceptive conduct in connection with the sale of securities, kicked it to the SEC to define what that meant, and the SEC has issued a couple of vague rules that sort of gesture in the direction of insider trading but do not by any means explicate it with any particular detail, and certainly not with sufficient detail to resolve a case like Newman by analyzing text or actually looking at some sort of criminal statute. All the courts have to resolve this case is common sense and analogical reasoning. Now, I, for one, don't think that we should be deciding whether somebody's conduct is illegal after they've engaged in the conduct based on analogical reasoning to prior decisions. It's not fair to the individual who should be allowed to structure his or her conduct in advance, in accordance with what is and is not illegal. And it's also not fair to us to everyone else from a policy perspective. As some of you may know, there's widespread disagreement in the academy about whether insider trading should be illegal at all. I am not an economist, and I am not an expert in securities law, so I don't know whether it should be illegal or not, but I do know that a lot of really smart people who are experts think it should not be, and that the securities markets would be better if it were not prohibited. I do know, though, that the right way to make legal policy on insider trading is not by leaving it to enforcement officials and whatever they can convince courts to go along with. Enforcement officials, quite understandably and quite appropriately, have a strong bias toward enforcement. Prosecutors want criminal laws to be broad because prosecutors believe that they only prosecute people who deserve it, and they want to have maximum discretion and ability to do that. There's nothing wrong with that. What is wrong with that is giving it to prosecutors playing that role to decide what the criminal law actually is in the context of enforcement actions. Courts are not well equipped to be the only sort of neutral arbiter in the system of how broad criminal law should be. Unlike a congressional committee or the SEC, courts cannot have expert testimony, they cannot take evidence from outside the case, and they are not really making generalized policy decisions in the context of resolving a discrete case. They're deciding whether X person is guilty of a crime, or in the SEC's case, has violated civil prohibitions in this particular case. And that's not really the best way to make policy, and it's certainly not how we make most of our policy in our democratic republic. So for all those reasons, and I think I'm coming right up to the total 30-minute mark, I understand why the court didn't take Newman. I think that makes sense, but I really think it's time for Congress or the SEC, and if they won't do it, for the Supreme Court to make them do it, to go out and actually define insider trading with some level of precision, where the courts and the prosecutors who are applying and enforcing these prohibitions are doing so on the basis of an actual statute or an actual regulation that prohibits something with text that can be analyzed, followed, and understood, rather than just prosecuting people for conduct that they might find distasteful, but that no prospective provision has clearly prohibited. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dean. Thank you.
Thank you both. We'll turn it over to the audience here in a moment. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So if you have a question for either of our experts, our lines are wide open at this point. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if someone rings in, let me do our typical commercial announcement at this point for upcoming Teleforum calls. We've got a full slate this week, including our call today, 5 calls. Tomorrow at 1, we'll have another Courthouse Steps Teleforum that's going to discuss a case that might be the court's next opportunity to revisit judicial review a la Chevron deference. That's tomorrow at 1 o'clock. That's a FERC case, but don't be fooled by that because it includes the questions of deference to FERC from the court. That's tomorrow at 1. Wednesday at 2, we'll be talking about the philosophical and intellectual underpinnings of intellectual property, a book by Randy May, including the author and some others on the Teleforum. Thursday, our topic will be the Redskins trademark case, which has been much in the newspaper. And then Friday, we'll be talking about the DOJ Yates memo, not unrelated, I guess, to today's topic in the sense that it's prosecution. And the question there in the Yates memo is how much to emphasize prosecution of corporate entities versus individuals. Today, of course, we're talking about this insider trading case. Our lines are open. We don't have any questions pending. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Here's our first question of the day. So I was going to ask a question, but let's turn to our caller instead.
Yeah, it's David Emerson, society member in Berkeley. I mean, I understand that this is a criminal liability case. My question, and I'm just asking for comments from the participants, is whether there was also discussion of the civil liability, so the correlative civil liability issues under Reg FD and selective disclosure, and the role of the SEC in that, and the potential for civil liabilities injunctions alongside the criminal issues here.
This is James. And Peter, please weigh in here too. But my understanding is that these laws are totally parallel, and so they're perfect reflections of each other in the civil and the criminal arena. And I think I read today that after the Supreme Court, or just today, or maybe it was last Friday, the SEC dismissed its civil cases against the guys that were involved in the Newman prosecutions. And that actually, I think, underscores a point I had made earlier about how having courts reviewing enforcement decisions really isn't the right way to make policy. You know, some of the biggest decisions on the scope of insider trading law come from SEC enforcement actions, which are civil enforcement actions. You know, the rules about how we interpret statutes, how we interpret regulations, and what we think about when we do so are completely different in the criminal context than they are in the civil. So there's something very weird about having these statutes get expanded in SEC enforcement actions and then used aggressively by criminal prosecutors to prosecute people and actually put them in prison. And with that, I'll kick it back to Peter.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I'm a criminal, white-collar criminal defense lawyer and not so much of a civil lawyer, but I do know in the civil context of the civil enforcement actions by the SEC, it's a somewhat weaker standard. And I think there's – James, I don't know if you recall, but there's a reckless disregard standard instead of a knowledge standard. And I know there was the Obis decision, I think it was 2012, in the Second Circuit. And I'm trying to remember, that was a tippy case. There was, I think, actual knowledge of the breach of duty was not required to establish liability in that case for Tipper and Tippy, at least in the Tipper's context. I think that's where they relied just on reckless disregard of the nature of the information for the Tipper. And for the Tippy, I think the standard was, in that case, only that he had a reason to know, not that he knew. So I'm not really sure how Newman affects the civil standard. And, I mean, that's one of the lingering questions, right? And I can throw this back to you, James. I mean, after Newman, where do we stand after Newman? I mean, apparently, and I read recently that at least one congressman wants to introduce legislation to make it illegal to trade on this confidential information, regardless of the source. And, you know, another question, big question in my mind, not only how Newman affects the civil enforcement actions, but does it apply, how does it apply to the misappropriation theory? I think the mere friendship theory in both criminal and civil is probably, at least from a Southerner's point of view, a gone pecan at this point, if you're talking about just mere friendship. But we have all these lingering questions, you know, and will this limit, as I say, also will this limit the SEC and civil enforcement actions? I don't think we know the answer to that question.
No, I think that's this is James again. I just wanted to add one thing. I think that's right, and I think that kind of illustrates, you know, one of the problem here. I mean, it's, you know, if you're a financial manager, what are you supposed to do? I mean, if Congress just said it was illegal to trade on material non-public information, at least that would be a very clear rule that you could follow. But what are you supposed to do when there's this extremely amorphous benefit standard in a judicial decision, and you're sitting there trying to get the best return for your investors you can? It puts people, the people who actually have to live under these laws, in a really tricky position.
Right. You know, I mean, although I feel the Supreme Court missed an opportunity here to take this, even if, you know, I know the SG only took the writ on the issue of what constitutes benefit, at least I think that's what it was taken on. I still think the court missed an opportunity here to clarify some of this law and maybe put some pressure on Congress to actually write a law that specifically addresses insider trading. But I do think that the Second Circuit was right. I think that they did strike that balance between, you know, integrity of market analysis by these brokers and analysts to do their best job aggressively for their clients, you know, to invest against you know, criminalizing anyone who trades on information and makes money, regardless of what they know downstream from wherever the tip comes from. And I think at some point on that downstream road, you've got to draw a line in the sand and say, government, you're going too far. This is going too far. I mean, there is this principle of mens rea, right, that people have to know what they're doing, have some idea what they're doing is against the law. And I think criminalizing it that far was improper for the government to seek to do. And I think the Second Circuit was right, but I still think the Supreme Court missed an opportunity here to put some pressure on Congress to pass a law.
Once again, if you want to join the conversation, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We were just hearing from Peter Thompson. Let me ask you the question, James, while we're waiting on our callers here. Do you agree that the Supreme Court missed an opportunity here? Would you have preferred that the Supreme Court, take this case to offer its insights?
Yeah, so look, I mean, it's certainly good news for Mr. Newman and his co-defendant, Mr. Chiasson, that the court denied cert, because now this ordeal for them has ended. The government cannot prosecute them again. So I certainly understand what the court's thinking might have been, insofar as this isn't the best vehicle to decide the issue. That being said, you know, I do think it would have been nice for them to take the case, in part because I don't think there's any chance, or virtually no chance, that the court would have taken the case and reversed. I was a little surprised that the SG decided to file a petition here. I mean, I suppose the reason they did it is that the Second Circuit oversees the vast majority of financial criminal allegations, and so what the heck, if the Second Circuit's done it, we might as well take our shot at the court. But the Supreme Court has not been receptive to aggressive interpretations of federal criminal statutes in the past few years. You know, the more famous examples are also a little more ridiculous, like the use of Sarbanes-Oxley to prosecute a fisherman for throwing undersized grouper overboard, the use of the International Chemical Weapons Treaty in United States versus Bond to prosecute a woman who essentially tried to burn her neighbor's thumb with some chemicals she stole from her office. I mean, these are really wacky prosecutorial theories. But I don't think that means, I mean, I think generally those just illustrate what the mood at the court overall, which is that the federal government has been a little more aggressive than it should be with a lot of these criminal statutes. And I don't think that we would have seen a deviation from that trend had they taken Newman. So, yeah, I mean, all in all, it would have been nice to have them take the case, but I understand why they didn't.
Once again, push star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you have a question. Let me ask you a question, James. I take it most of these insider trading cases are going to come through the Second Circuit. So to the extent this issue is decided in the Second Circuit, that's pretty broad. So that's my first question. The second question is there otherwise a circuit split on this issue?
So, in the first question, the answer to that is yes. I mean, the Manhattan obviously is in the Second Circuit, and Manhattan is obviously where most financial trading happens. But of course, now that the Second Circuit has this rule, I could easily imagine the government bringing more of these cases in places that aren't the Second Circuit to avoid this rule, because people trade securities all over the country, and there's plenty of hedge funds that aren't in New York or Connecticut. As far as whether there's a split, as I understand it, although I haven't read the opinion, Judge Rakoff, who's an SDNY judge of all people, was sitting by designation in the Ninth Circuit and actually wrote an opinion that I think to some extent disagrees with the Newman decision. And so there may be at least an incipient split at this point. The other thing, though, too, is even if the Supreme Court had taken the case just to resolve the issue that was decided by the Second Circuit rather than to assess insider trading law more broadly, it would have been nice to have them issue a decision not only to get a uniform national rule, but because I'm hopeful that the Supreme Court would have issued a decision that was a little more clear and a little more assertive than the Second Circuit's decision was. The Second Circuit's decision is a great decision, and I think they did a really good job, but it's not perfectly clear what they mean when they talk about a benefit with some possibility of pecuniary gain. And I wonder whether the Supreme Court would have drawn a clearer line that people would have been able to understand better had it decided the case.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I think both of you have sort of alluded to the idea, this is still Dean, we don't have a question pending yet, that the court has knocked down a couple enforcement actions, criminal enforcement actions by the federal government. You cited Bonds, Bond case and the Yates case, James. Is this a change in the court's perspective? Do you attribute it to that, the court's just taking a closer look, or do you want to stick with the statement that I thought I heard you make, that the government is essentially stretching things here and bringing some maybe unconventional criminal enforcement actions? Which is it, or is it a combination of both?
So this is James again. Let me answer the second part of that first. The government vis-a-vis the court in criminal cases is sort of interesting because the Solicitor General's office doesn't really get involved unless there's an appeal by the government or the case actually gets taken up by the court. So a lot of these cases where the facts are kind of nutty are cases where a local AUSA has indicted the case, won the case, the criminal defendant has appealed, the local prosecutor's office, the U.S. Attorney's office has won the appeal, and then the defendant has filed a cert petition. So, it's not clear that it's like, Maine Justice's fault that, for example, they prosecuted a woman for using chemicals against her neighbor under the International Convention or Chemical Weapons Treaty. So, I'm not sure whether it's the government's been more aggressive or whether the court's mood has changed. I do think the court has become a lot more sensitive to these issues in the last few years, and I'm not totally sure why, other than that there's been four new justices brought to the court, some of whom may have had more experience with these overcriminalization issues. And also, if you look at Skilling versus United States, which was the last really big vagueness case on a liability statute, three of the justices wanted to strike down the honest services statute as being unconstitutionally vague. And it could very well be that the combination of unusual facts and those justices beating on this drum has just started to have an effect up there and make the court more receptive to criminal defendants challenging what some justices view as federal overreach. Peter?
You mentioned vagueness, and certainly that term comes to mind with the Rule 10b-5. But I'm curious, your opinion on the mail and wire fraud statutes. You know, they just, you know, prohibit a scheme and artifice to defraud. And, you know, I've been wondering, you know, what's the difference between that and the fraudulent language contained in these rules? And, you know, thinking through that, I'm not quite sure there is much of a difference. I was curious on your opinion on that as well.
So,
I'm one of the lawyers
who represents former Virginia Governor McDonnell in his case, which involves those statutes, so I probably shouldn't comment.
Okay.
We have a cert petition that's been filed that's on SCOTUS blog, and you might get a sense of what we think from that.
Right.
This is Dean. Let me invite the audience once again. Push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question. Let me ask a more general question, and it's about the court's view of the federal government, I guess even state governments. Maybe it's just government versus the individual, but there's skepticism about some of the criminal law cases, you know, setting the death penalty aside. There seems to be a resurgence, not just in the cases that you've cited today, but the court's confrontation clause jurisprudence, the search and seizure, the drug sniffing, and the Kylo case, the heat sensing case, with Justice Scalia in the forefront in a lot of these cases, taking the side of the individual versus the government. Do you see any larger themes there? Is this just sort of the government looking out for the Supreme Court looking out for individuals versus the state or the federal government when it comes to criminal law?
Well, I think – this is James again. I mean, I do think that people have realized that the path to victory at the Supreme Court on these criminal procedure issues is through originalism. And that is a real testament to Justice Scalia's intellectual honesty, because I can't imagine he's that sympathetic to a lot of the people who are being prosecuted in these cases. And, you know, to the wisdom of the criminal defense bar in realizing that. I mean, that those cases are all – or mostly pretty originalist decisions in which members of the court that aren't necessarily the most originalist have realized that if they would like to, you know, get to the outcomes that they believe are legally appropriate, the best way to do it, you know, to get five votes to do it, is to make common cause with the originalists. So I think that's probably my best explanation for it, is just that Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas have been very principled originalists, and that can lead to, you know, outcomes that some might call quote-unquote liberal, but that are totally consistent with their general philosophies.
Let me make a final call for questions here. If you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Gentlemen, I don't see any more questions from the audience, so I'm going to come back to each of you to get a final thought or give you a chance to wrap up. And why don't we go in the same order we started. Peter Thompson, a final thought here?
Well, you know, my final thought is really the overarching thought that Congress should step in and pass an explicit legislation defining insider trading. And I think without that, the state of the law will continue to evolve in a somewhat confusing, two steps forward, one step back manner. And it will leave us in disarray, and particularly not only in the criminal context, but in the civil enforcement context as well.
James Burnham, a final thought.
Yeah, this is James. I totally agree with what Peter just said, and I think, you know, look, it's very passing statutes on criminal justice issues is very hard. You know, Congress has trouble passing anything, but they have a lot of trouble dealing with criminal law issues because they're complicated, they're tricky, and they're very subject to hyperbole. But this is a case where the Congress really needs to do something, because you've got a lot of people out there engaging in conduct every day without really knowing which side of the criminal line it falls on, and it's just not somewhere where it makes sense to kick it to the courts and the Department of Justice to sort this out on their own. And if Congress won't do it, at the very least the SEC should, issue some regulations that are clear and that can control these things in a prospective basis. I think if they did so, it would actually be better for enforcement officials, because then all the prosecutions and enforcement actions they brought would be more legitimate. They'd be based on a prospective regulation that they could say that, you know, defendant A or defendant B had clearly violated. Whereas now everything is up for debate and people don't feel like the system is as fair as it could or should be. That's all I've got. Thank you, Dean.
Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. I certainly appreciate your time here today, both Peter Thompson and James Burnham. To our audience, thank you for dialing in, and thank you for your questions. A reminder that our next scheduled teleforum call is tomorrow at 1 p.m. when we'll be talking about the FERC case that might be a chance for the court to revisit deference. Until that next call, though, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.